Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. We have a very special episode today, and who better to produce that than our number one super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
What?
Ta-da!
It is and,
yeah, Noel, you're Noel, I'm Ben, and you and I recently watched a film on Netflix called Operation Mincemeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I initially thought it was going to be some sort of British baking kind of show situation, but it turns out it was British, but there's very little baking, precious little baking in Operation Mincemeat. Ben, do you know what mincemeat is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mincemeat is, well, you know me, man. I'm a walking garbage can when it comes to food. I eat all sorts of stuff.
You and me both, buddy.
Basically, it's like, it's weird to call it meat. It always has been to me because it's suet, but then a lot of dried fruit and spices. And I think they distill some spirits of some sort, some kind of boozy thing that cooks down and doesn't have a lot of alcohol in it, do the cooking process. And then you put it in like a pastry.
Suet. Isn't that just like beef juice? Like beef slime, basically?
Yeah, it's fat. Pretty sure. And suet doesn't always have to be beef. It can come from like lamb as well. It's specifically, I thought, someone checked me on this, I thought it was a kind of fat around the loins and the kidneys of the animal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not that far off from the consistency of aspic. If you've ever had any weird gelatinous 70s kind of dishes with things preserved in jelly or whatever, aspic is, you know, there are some really good, if you get like, if you're into the stuff, which I know is controversial, but there's different ways to make it that are more humane than goose pate, but there are different types of pate that sometimes will have a layer of like a ginger kind of like fruited aspic on top, and beef suet is not too far from that. But we're not talking about the actual dish mincemeat, which would be usually served in a pie crust of some kind, a mincemeat pie. We are in fact talking about an operation carried out by British intelligence that may well have been one of the prime movers in swinging the tide of World War II.
Yeah, absolutely correct. And funny story, they came up with the name because British intelligence at the time had kind of this list of common names that you would pull from. That was really interesting to me, the idea that maybe there were a bunch of guys kind of brainstorming in a room and they said, okay, what are we going to call this next one? And someone said, you know, maybe they skipped lunch and someone's like, I don't call it mincemeat, you know, but they did apparently have a list of approved names. You're right, Noel. This was a big, big deal and it happened in utter secrecy. So we want to talk a little bit today about the real life events that informed the film you can see on Netflix today. This operation was a result of intelligence agencies always trying to fake each other out. So the British invented a ghoulishly creative way of delivering fake intel in Spain, which was neutral at this time in 1943, and they wanted it to end up with the German forces. And you know, I was thinking, man, we're channeling a bit of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know Today, another show that we do. And this one is a real life conspiracy. Weirdly enough, and you can go back and forth on how far they should have leaned into this with the film. Weirdly enough, the entire idea starts with fly fishing. Not a euphemism, straight up like casting the reel, got a little fake fly on there.
Yeah, but it also, like, you know, was used as a metaphor, right? Like in this document called the Trout Memo, I believe, that was then presented to a committee called the 20 Committee, or the Committee of 20. And it just shows how deep some of these very clever British quips go with some of these project names and code names, because, you know, 20 was not referring to the number of members in the council or whatever you want to call it. It was not referring to the number 20 exactly. It was referring to the Roman numeral 20, XX, meaning double crosses. So it was a organization that was specifically designed to do exactly what you said, Ben, to fake out other intelligence agencies and governments through elaborate ruses and ultimately deception. And that is very much what went into the thinking behind Operation Mincemeat. It was a way to send faulty information to the Germans so that they would act on that information, believing that it was true, giving the Americans or the Allied forces the advantage.
Yeah, and we owe a big debt to historian Ben McIntyre. Actually, the film Operation Mincemeat is based primarily on his work. It's nuts because there are parts in the film where people are saying, with all sincerity, and there's a real thing, they're saying, "Yes, I know so and so. He thought I was a double agent when I was a triple agent. Keep your eye on that one." And it's like, how many times do you go with this song and dance of this weird tango of who's betraying whom? This guy named Rear Admiral John Godfrey, here's why it starts with fly fishing. He digs fly fishing. He's super into this Trout Memo, and it's some Sun Tzu Art of War stuff, because the metaphor is, you know, just like you said, they love a metaphor. So the metaphor is that you can deceive your enemy the way that someone fishing can deceive a fish. We pulled a quote here just to give you a sense of it. "The trout fisher casts patiently all day. He frequently changes his venue and his lures. If he has frightened a fish, he may give the water a rest for half an hour. But his main endeavor, vis-a-vis, to attract fish by something he sends out from his boat, is incessant."
Incessant. I love that. There's a great scene in the movie where this guy presents the Trout Memo to Winston Churchill. I didn't know the actor who was playing Churchill. It's obviously like a really, you know, sought after role of, you know, some of the best actors have portrayed Churchill, specifically Gary Oldman, you know, and like an unrecognizable amount of prosthetics. But this dude did a really kind of not over the top. It's an easy one to like chew the scenery with, because Churchill was a real character and known for these fiery speeches and turns of phrase. But the guy said, I forget who it was. It was because one of, I think his assistant or one of the guys who was in this kind of cadre of military brass that were walking around with Churchill was Ian Fleming, the author of, you know, the James Bond novels. And he based his James Bond characters on people that he actually knew and some of the operations that he actually participated in. But the point is, the guy says to Churchill, "Have you heard of the Trout Memo?" And Churchill just goes, "I despise fish."
That sounds like Churchill.
And then he walks away, and then he says something like, they're describing the Trout Memo as describing these very fantastic and elaborate methods of deception. And Churchill replies like, you know, I'm fond of the elaborate and fantastic. It's much better than the mundane.
Yes.
Like, and then he says, but, you know, in order to pull off something elaborate, it has to be beyond foolproof.
Yeah, that's the thing. And this paper, this memo, builds on this fly fishing metaphor. It lists all in all 54 different what if ways that the United Kingdom could try to deceive their enemies, the Axis forces, just the same way a fly fisher could, like, they lean into it, is what we're saying.
Wouldn't this have been kind of an early codification of, like, spycraft, like, in the UK?
The Great Game had been continuing apace for a while. I would say it's fair to call this kind of part of the dawn of modern tradecraft or spycraft. So they're deep in stuff. They're, as corporate America says, they're building the plane while they fly it. Today's story is not about the entirety of the Trout Memo. You basically got the gist, folks. It's about the 28th suggestion in that weird paper, the idea of getting a dead body, planting fake intel on that dead body, and then just sort of dropping it somewhere where German intelligence will find it. And they didn't make up this idea, by the way. They got it from a novel because Admiral Godfrey and Ian Fleming were working together. Godfrey loved fishing. Fleming loved fiction. And I think about it sometimes, like generals, admirals, they're very, very busy people, the top brass. So how do you communicate with someone like that? You make it something relatable to them. So instead of saying, hey man, let's start using dead bodies to trick people, he opened with, you know what war is a lot like, Admiral? It's like fishing. And he's like, oh, I like fishing.
Yeah, I can wrap my head around that. I can get behind that. It's interesting though. We were talking about this on our group text thread. There is a kind of a running gag in the movie where basically like everyone is a writer. Everyone's working on a novel. It's pretty funny. Several of the top brass type characters are in fact working on novels, and it becomes this kind of like fun running joke in the movie. But yeah, it's true. They got the idea from a novel. I don't recall which one. I don't know if that comes up necessarily in the movie, but it is maybe. It sounds like the kind of deception you would see as the twist in like a detective novel, like Poirot or like, you know, Sherlock Holmes or something like that, right? So think about it. The idea is to pass off this body as a genuine soldier, a genuine, you know, human being who died in the, course of serving their country and, you know, planting false information on them so that the Germans would find it in the hopes that they would believe it to be true. They knew that they would do an autopsy and make sure that the body was in fact, you know, because there's all this paranoia at the time. You know, they would not accept anything at face value. So they had to go about this in the most meticulous way you could imagine. Like, they created a backstory for this person. We'll get into the details of that. But first, before any of that fun stuff, which all involves like writing stories, it's like a story Bible. You're creating, you know, a living, breathing human being that is actually entirely fictionalized. You got to find a body first, a viable specimen that isn't too old, that hasn't been mutilated in any kind of way, that, like, you know, it looks like it was someone that just went down with their plane and drowned.
Yeah, and you have to do it in utter secrecy. So yeah, You're playing that Goldilocks game for the perfect corpse, basically. And you have to do this without letting too many people in on the plan. So Admiral Godfrey is pretty hot to trot about this Trout Memo thing because he needs a solution and fast. He is aware of an upcoming plan, a different operation called Operation Husky.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a three-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, nah, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves and it's super convenient. And it actually, like, we tried to find a catch and there's not one.
So to get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh, boy, have I ever been.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. The Allied forces are planning to invade the island of Sicily, you know, off of Italy, and they were worried that it would be tough to pull this off. They said, okay, we could invade Greece, we could invade the Balkans. What should we do?
I think the issue with Sicily was that it was just a no-duh kind of move, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was just the obvious weakness or the obvious, you know, point of entry. And anyone, that they said a couple of times, like anyone with a map could tell you that. So Right. They were going to be expected. It would have been the most obvious place. So that's a problem because it's like, even if it makes the most sense, your enemy also knows that and they're going to act accordingly. So the point is they needed to figure out a way to make the Germans believe they weren't going to do the thing the Germans knew they definitely were going to do. How do you do that?
Right, exactly. And that's a good way to put it, man. So they already kind of knew, and history would prove this, they already kind of knew that Axis powers had pretty insidious intelligence capabilities. There were tons of spies embedded in any agency you can imagine. And they knew that if Axis powers anticipated the obvious thing, Operation Husky, because they already did the North Africa campaign, so it's not too far for their resources to move. They knew that if the Germans were anticipating this, it would become a bloodbath. It would probably fail. Winston Churchill, who was basically drunk off the success of the North African campaign, low-key.
Possibly also actually drunk, too.
Yeah, I was going to say low-key just in general kind of drunk. And he knew in his calculus that Britain could probably not invade and retake France at this time. They needed more runway. And he said, okay, look, we can maybe, he was skeptical at first, but he said, we can maybe take these North African forces through the Mediterranean into Italy, which they loved calling the soft underbelly of Europe. Like they keep calling it that. It's weird. You know how it is like when you're hanging with your friends and you make up a catchphrase and everybody sort of gets into it.
Is that sort of a ding against the Italian people, implying that they're somehow like soft and luxuriating in their fine wines and cheeses?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that part out. But yeah, they leaned into that as well. So everybody's like, fly fishing is war. Soft underbellies. Let's invade Sicily. And to do this, they're not sure if it's actually going to happen yet. This story hinges on three people. We're going to introduce two of them now. Military officers Charles Chomley and Ewan Montague. Chomley is not spelled. Not spelled the way it sounds.
Charles Mondelet. It sort of like reminds me of some counties in Georgia. We've got one called, this looks like on paper, Taliaferro, but it's apparently pronounced Tolliver or something like that. Until I heard them say in the movie when I was reading about this, in my mind, I'm saying out loud, Charles Mondelet. And then when in the movie, they start calling this dude Chomley, and I'm like, where's Charles Mondelet? He's my favorite.
Right there with you. It's kind of like, and no offense to our good friends in Massachusetts, it's kind of like Worcester. You can't get mad at people for guessing wrong on that one. But here we are, the 28th suggestion. Chomley and Montague run with it. The lure in this case is a corpse. Not too fresh, not too stale, I guess.
Yeah, but it's a Goldilocks corpse.
Right. And it has to be dressed as your kind of average everyday soldier with that intel. And they originally wanted the fake intel to just be in the guy's pockets. The whole trick is their idea will be that German intelligence in Spain finds these papers and take them as gospel. If everything works out, enemy forces are going to find this dead guy. They're going to act on that secret info, and they're going to move their forces away from Sicily. And this all takes time, right? They can't just, you know, pop back over. They're going to move a significant amount of the German military and Axis military forces away from Sicily. Then that exposes the soft underbelly of Europe, and they're, you know, from then on, it's just like, God save the queen. Great job, everyone.
Oh, wait. I think I get it. So a soft underbelly is a point of weakness, right? Like in The Hobbit, you know how like Smaug had that one little area that like was like, what do they call it? Like naked as a snail without its shell or something like that. Mm. I think maybe that's what they're referring to Sicily as, like just a weak point. So a soft underbelly implying that like even if everything else is armored, you know, that if that soft underbelly is exposed, then that could be like a kill shot for all of Europe.
And to kind of jump in here, I mean, you got to think about at this point in 1943, like Germany is still kind of like an unstoppable machine, while like Italy and all their operations are just like tripping over themselves and face planting.
Yeah. And eating cheeses, fine cheeses and wines. Yes.
Like
yeah,
they were not doing very well in this war.
No, they weren't. That's very, very true. And this fake out itself is not a super original idea. Just the idea of faking people with bad intel. It's happened before. It's happened so often in the world of intelligence that by this point it had a street name. It was known as the Haversack Ruse. But Chomley and our boy Montague, they need a fresh body. And Chomley has his own spin on the Trout memo. He calls it the Trojan horse. Shout out to Dennis Smith, author of Deathly Deception, the real story of Operation Mincemeat. Thanks to Smith, we have Chomley's real life description of this. Noel, I know we both love leaning into a real chewy British accent. You want to give this one a shot, man?
Oh, why not? Let's see.
A body is obtained from one of the London hospitals. The lungs are filled with water and documents are disposed in an inside pocket. The body is then dropped by a coastal command aircraft. On being found, the supposition in the enemy's mind may well be that one of our aircraft has either been shot or forced down, and that this is one of their passengers.
Love it. 10-10. Ugh,
all the Brits out in the audience are cringing right now, and I am here for it. I'm here for it. I love all of you so much.
Yeah, and you know, we would love to do our own adaptation of Operation Mincemeat. And Max, Noel, maybe at the end, we can figure out who we're going to cast as ourselves.
Well, speaking of cast, I got to say and point out, this movie, really great cast. Charles McFadden, who I think we all, who plays Chalmley. I think we all know him as Tom Walmsgams from Succession. Fabulous show. And he's another one of these British actors who, like, I just would never have thought was British. I mean, I have no reason to worry about it or think about it, but he just pulls off that American accent so well. That does not always go the other way around when it comes to American actors doing British voices. I would not call myself, nor I think you, an actor per se. I know you've done more acting than I, but as evidenced by our butchery of the English accent. But it's really funny when you have, like, you know, a Kevin Costner or something vaguely attempting to phone in the slightest of British accents that sort of comes and goes, you know?
The first 10 minutes of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves slap. I don't really.
Oh, it's great. The escape from that prison.
Yeah, that's very dope. Good. But yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I would also say, just to throw an olive branch slash bone to our fellow British ridiculous historians. Yes, we know Americans are the ones with the accent. You guys were there also first. True. Everybody gets it. So, even Max is nodding solemnly. He's like, I'll allow it. Okay, so I just want to paint the picture here. So Max, I don't want to put you on the spot, but Max thought about it when I said that and then leaned forward toward his mic and then kind of gave a little smile, like leaned back, like, not yet, not yet.
Yeah, sometimes I just like, do I have the energy for this fight right now? Do I really have the energy for this, Ben? And this was one of the moments I leaned back and I was just like, no. I don't.
I will not die on this hill today, my friends. I will live to fight another. But Ben, didn't they have like a special hookup, like, to get these bodies? Like, they had like a body guy, right?
Yeah. They have a body guy eventually, because first Chalmley pitches this to his buds at MI5 and the 20 committee, who are running all his double agents, and they're not super convinced. It's like November 1942, and they essentially tell him, dude, there's absolutely no way this will work, but I like where your head's at. I like the way you think about things, and we need to attach this, go back to the drawing board, keep your original idea, let's punch it up, and that's when Ewan Montague comes in. He's naval intelligence. He's in charge of counter-espionage, and he's going to work with Chalmley. They go through the details, and then they get a due date. The top brass says this invasion of Sicily, Operation Husky, has to happen by July of 1943. So tick-tock, 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 find us a dead body. It's weird because everybody kind of knew that everyone was spying on each other. They didn't even kind of know this. This is the only way they were able to pull this off. But they were trying to figure out what Adolf Hitler thought. Adolf Hitler was never a particularly talented strategist. And he was really, really focused, not so much on Sicily, but on the Balkans, because Germany was not a resource-rich country. If the war machine that was running through Europe was to continue, then they needed copper, oil, you name it, all sorts of resources from the Balkans. Without it, their war effort would collapse. So the Allies go through this whole dog and pony show. They invent another fake operation called Operation Barclay. It's meant to convince Germany that the Allies are going toward the Balkans. They made up a fictional military formation. They did a bunch of fake operations in Syria. It's like real look at me stuff. And just like you said, Noel, the whole time, our guys Chalmley and Montague are like the resurrection men of the Middle Ages. They're searching for that body. They said, okay, yeah, no, we've decided it's fine to steal a body, dress it up, and throw it somewhere. We don't have a lot of time to wax philosophic. Let's make the corpse look convincing. You got to work on a backstory, but also these guys are not experts what death looks like. And like you said, they're not the type of guys who walk around saying, oh, you need a body? I'll get you a body. Wait, you need it by four? They don't know.
No, they don't know. They end up connected with somebody at like a morgue of some kind, I believe, right? Like they have direct access to. So they had to make the scenario, under which this person's body was found believable. So it couldn't be like some sort of you know, grisly death, you know, that where there was like mangling or mutilation of any kind. It needed to be a body with very few marks on it. It would have been someone that had gone down in a plane, presumably crashed into the ocean, the open ocean, and then drowned. And then, you know, I was wondering, would they have then, you know, looked for the plane to confirm? But, you know, Max and Ben off air pointed out that it just would have been too much. Too many resources would have been required to do that. There were other ways that could have confirmed the validity of this person's, you know, credentials, and if this was a real British soldier. So the body they got was a guy who had recently been discovered dead from ingesting rat poison in a warehouse, presumably a suicide. There certainly are scenarios where maybe it was accident. You know, he accidentally ate rat poison, or he got mixed into his rations, because this was a time of super austerity. I kind of forgot about that until watching this and this film, remembering that, like, you know, a blitz was just over the horizon every single day. So it was like there was power outages. You know, people, life did go on, and there certainly were high society things that took place. But in general, the general population was eating, like, you know, spam and, like, rations and, like, you know, what do you call those things? MREs and stuff, right?
Yeah, food was being rationed. It was a serious concern, and a lot of people were dying. So it's weird then, from Chomley and Montague's perspective. We'll call him the Chomster and Monty. Yeah, let's do that. Okay, so the Chomster and Monty are in a weird situation because they're saying this is a huge war. There are bodies everywhere. How come we have to search so ardently for the right one? They get help by with two people. One is a pathologist named Sir Bernard Spilsbury, and he says, all right, here's how you make it look like someone died the right way. He pointed out, and I didn't know this, that people, when they die in plane crashes over water, are often going to die of shock instead of drowning. And that means their lungs might not necessarily fill up with water. And then he had a hot take. I'm not a pathologist myself. Here's what he said. He said, you know, if we're talking about Spanish people finding them, Spanish folks are all Catholic, and Catholics don't like doing postmortems unless it's a really big deal. So we can kind of get away with a body that's died in any number of fashions. And, you know, it could be anybody's guess, especially if the body's been in the ocean for a few days. So that's what leads them to hook up with their resurrection man, their corpseman. He's a coroner named Bentley Purchase, January 28th, 1943. Yeah.
The Britishness of these names just delights me to no end.
I'm so envious.
They sound like characters in Toast of London or something. It's great. Bentley. Oh, Ray Purchase. That's why. Ray bloody Purchase.
Right.
Bentley Purchase. If anyone isn't, I mean, I'm sure our British listeners are intimately familiar, but the new season of Toast is, he goes stateside, Toast of Tinseltown, and it's just a delight with Matt Berry. He's one of my favorite human beings in the world. So
his music's good, too.
His music's great. He makes these very non-ironic kind of, I mean, maybe they're a little ironic, but I would say pretty straight kind of like 60s psychedelic folk records that are like super good. He's got one called Kill the Wolf and another one. And the covers are great. They're like him posing with like a pheasant,
a hawk,
you know? So good. But in any case, they've, like, to your point, Ben, they found this corpseman who was the coroner at a medical, you know, a government morgue, essentially. And he's like, I got the guy for you, the dude I was talking about, who was a not well-off person who had suffered from some mental illness, had been on the streets. In the film, we later see a family member of his kind of surface. But this is a guy named Glendwyr Michael, another fabulously British name. That actually sounds almost like Welsh, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Glendwyr with the W and the R. But his body looked good. There are some really fun macabre bits in the film, though, because you do see them trying to pose this dead body in, like, his military garb for, like, they need to do, like, an ID badge photo.
Right.
And, you know, a corpse doesn't really pose, you know, and there's some one particularly amazingly macabre shot where they try to make him smile, and it just, yeah, it looks great. Whatever they did to make, I don't know how they did that exactly, but the way the body moves, it must be prosthetics, but it looked like something out of Night of the Living Dead. But it was just, you know, they're kind of just like fumbling with it, and his head keeps flopping over and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they realize, okay, this isn't going to work. We need to, now we found a body that fits the bill. Now we have to find a live body that somewhat resembles this man, so we can get a photo to have, you know, on him as his military ID. By the way, they dubbed this character, this creation, Major William Martin.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Right. Earlier, I said there are kind of three main characters of this story. Glyndwr Michael, known as Major William Martin, is our third man. Feels like a noir reference. You can find a photo, just what you're describing, Noel, online if you wish, Ridiculous Historians. It is grisly, be warned, but it's off to the races. They've got the documents. They've you know, habeas corpus. They have the body. And on April 30th, 1943, they take action because Bentley Purchase has told them, look, I can keep this guy on ice, but at best, I can give you 3 months or else he will have just decayed too far to be useful. So that's why they ship him off then in April. And they've still got that July ticking time bomb there, that deadline. The captain of a submarine called HMS Serif has his crew push this body into the sea, and they push it in the direction of the tide, and they actually use the submarine's propellers to help move the body in what they hope is the right direction. I want to shout out the captain of that sub, Lieutenant Norman Jewell, who had the decency to stage something like a funeral service. He read the 39th Psalm, which begins talking about the power of silence. And that's the only funeral that Michael actually gets. The body washes ashore on the Spanish coast near a city called Huelva. And this is exactly where they wanted it to go.
because they knew, right? Even though Spain was like, quote unquote, neutral, everybody knew the British spies were there, Allied spies, German spies are there. And they said, okay, just to like preserve this so that the papers are still legible, we can't put it in this dude's pockets. We have to put it in a briefcase. So they attach a briefcase to him. And it seems legit.
What's the amazing term they used for pocket trash? I think it's like wallet litter.
Yes. Something like that. Something like that.
I really like it. There's so many of these bespoke little kind of like niche terms that they throw around in this film that are a lot of fun. I'm serious. You know, just to put this out there, Netflix did not sponsor this episode. We just genuinely liked the movie and thought it was worth talking about, and it gave us a topic that we hadn't really thought about, that we hadn't done. So definitely go check out the movie. I don't think we're spoiling too much of it. Even if you know the story, it's still the dramatization. There's definitely a lot of schmaltzing all this stuff up the purposes of cinema. And I honestly think they don't ever go too terribly far. A couple things made me cringe a little bit, like a bit of a overdone love story angle. But in general, I think we all three quite enjoyed the film.
Jason Isaacs is amazing.
We were talking about that off air. Yeah. And I love Colin Firth. So Colin, if you're hearing this, man, great job. Great job, dude. And I mean,
and Jason Isaacs, if you're hearing this, I love you.
Yeah, he's dreamy, man. Look at those baby blues. God, you could just swim in them.
They're so piercing. As a man with piercing blue eyes, I can appreciate piercing blue eyes.
Game recognized.
He's got me beat.
There we go. Sure. Nailed it. All right, Max, we're going to see if we can get you and Jason to hang out together. You know.
Oh, he was in The Death of Stalin, which is another movie that fantastic. I think ridiculous historians would absolutely love if you haven't seen it. That is a cool movie and another really fun dramatization of some really heavy historical stuff, but played completely straight, where it's like nobody has a Russian accent in the movie. It's all just like everyone's themselves, and it's
Steve
great.
Buscemi is just being Steve Buscemi.
He's just Steve Buscemi. It's right. Wonderful.
That's American acting, you know? But if you were a German spy there in Spain and you saw this, these papers, then they would look legit because it's a very clever counterfeiting move. The people who made the fake papers are the same people who make the real papers.
Right.
So they're making their own counterfeits. You would not be able to tell the difference without more information. A fisherman finds and retrieves, quote unquote, Martin's body. And then, of course, it makes it to German intelligence in the city. They look at this and they say, holy smokes, that's where the Brits are going. They're faking us out. You know, Sicily's too obvious. They're coming for Greece and Sardinia. We got to get moving.
I mean, I also want to make sure we give credit to the other members of the 20 who, you know, trumped up all of this incredibly detailed backstory for this man. It was really like, you know, writer's room. I mean, it was no wonder the writing and, you know, being a novelist, such a theme in the movie, because these people were responsible for creating believable fictions. They gave him a love interest named, what was it, guys? Pam?
Mm-hmm. Pam. There's a snapshot of his fiancée on his person.
Mm-hmm. And they make a point to like, no, the picture of Pam goes in his breast pocket because he keeps it close to his heart. You know what I mean? Aww. Stuff like that. You know, there's a love letter that he keeps on him as well. And also, I believe, a receipt for a wedding ring.
Yep.
You know, so like it was one of these things where it's like, I'll, you know, the love letter says something like, it's such a shame that we were to meet during the war or else we'd surely be married by now. And it's all really, it goes through all these revisions too, where like, you know, all of the MI6, MI5, Churchill's office and all of that, they all get their hands in the pie, kind of rewriting and second guessing everything. But at the end of the day, all of this stuff is found along with these documents in this case that tell this tale, right? Mm-hmm. But in the most kind of obfuscating ways. It would have taken them a minute to kind of have to figure out what was going on. And not only that, they then continued the ruse by using unsecured lines they knew were being monitored by German intelligence and saying how worried they were that their man had been found and of the sensitive nature of the papers that he was carrying.
Right. Yeah, it was a huge deal. There's a lot of acting there, too, because he also has like a letter from his father, ticket stubs. You could tell he bought a fancy shirt recently, a hotel bill, all this stuff. And they really, really, really put some work into making it plausible. And I would argue that the communications that were, you know, being monitored were probably the clincher for German forces, right? Because if this guy was carrying secret papers, he's this important, then of course British intelligence will worry about him. If they hadn't done that little part of the song and dance, then Germany may have figured out the ruse. But it worked. It seemed successful. Invasion of Sicily began on July 9th. It went until August 17th. The German military, because they fell for this con game, had already moved a big part of their forces to Greece. This would prove to be the first foray in the Italian campaign, also known as the Liberation of Italy, continued till 1945, leading to the death of Benito Mussolini, which is still kind of mystery. Historians will debate the official narrative about that. You remember Benito Mussolini, fellow ridiculous historians. He was that guy who, among other things, was super into the idea of wearing milk.
I'm sorry?
Wearing milk. Benito Mussolini. He's the wearable milk guy.
Oh, right. The also wearable dictator. Milk guy. No, yeah. I'm remembering now. It was like a it was like a more sustainable kind of plastic, essentially, right. With like, it almost was like, think of Kraft singles or something that you could like, you know, stitch together and cover your body with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So check out that episode. I think we all had a blast on that one. And at this point, we have to ask, what can we learn from this? I mean, Operation Mincemeat shows us kind of the ethical quandaries of the greater good. And also, Glyndwr Michael had no informed consent. He didn't have any say in his second posthumous identity.
Yeah, and in the film, I don't know how dramatized this was, but his sister, I don't remember how she gets wind of it exactly, because it was so hush-hush, but she comes into the office and, like, you know, makes a big fuss and says, you know,
God, I think she went to the coroner because, you know, there was a lot of people like who didn't understand where the body went.
That makes sense. Somehow she ended up in the presence of our main characters, you know, doing a shame on you type situation and like how poor, you know, Glyndwr never had a say in this and all the, you know, because I mean, these are deeply religious people and like, you know, the idea of what they're doing is desecrating a corpse, you know?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I mean, there's a scene in the movie when the Spanish do get a hold of the body and they do that autopsy. It is foul. Like they're like pulling his guts out. They look like freaking, you know, sausages. It's really, and then like one of the reasons they didn't go deeper into conducting the autopsy to see the cause of death was because it was just so foul smelling. You got like one Spanish officer like vomiting in the scene. Another macabre piece of, you know, cinema. There's a couple moments like that in the movie, but it is one of those weighing kind of situations where, yeah, they know what they're doing isn't great, but it was like the only thing they thought would actually, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, save the world. It was World War II. And you're right, Max. I mean, the Nazis were a killing machine. They were a precision engineered killing machine, just like ripping their way across Europe. And if Hitler had had his way, he would have taken it even further than that.
Mm, yeah. And also, you know, there are so many conundrums with this, ethical, philosophical conundrums. Yes, mincemeat played a role in the ultimate Allied victory of World War II. But it's also important to remember that when the invasion of Sicily happened successfully, Allied forces were committing war crimes against innocent Sicilian citizens. And that's a story that doesn't often get told. But what we're seeing is creativity under desperate circumstances. Not for nothing is necessity called the mother of invention. And when driven to extreme means, people who consider themselves the good guys will do very shady things. So check out Operation Mincemeat. We thought it was a fantastic adaptation. Again, it's based on some great work by the historian Ben McIntyre. Ian Fleming plays a role and still went on to create the James Bond novels. As you said, Noel, pulling a lot from real life. This is just a wild one. I can't wait to hear more about obscure, weird operations.
Completely. And Ben, we sort of scratched the surface of this earlier, but it was in fact Ian Fleming who wrote the Trout Memo, and the idea for, you know, the body came from, you know, a detective novel. Like, again, we don't know exactly which one, but it was specifically a noirish type detective novel where, you know, this would have been like a ruse of some kind perpetrated by a criminal to cover their tracks, you know, or like a twist in like a drawing room murder mystery, you know?
Yeah, it was a book by a guy named Basil Thompson. But yes, we saw fiction become fact. This is such a nuts story. And, you know, I don't know. Are you guys World War II history buffs at all?
I'm a fan. I wouldn't say I'm enough to consider myself a buff, but I know enough to be dangerous, I guess. But I definitely find it fascinating because, I mean, it was such an all-encompassing conflict that really just, you know, kind of came on the tails of World War One and so many things that connected to. And it really was something that could have absolutely just changed the course of civilization, you know? So this was a kind of like winner-take-all kind of gambit, and they won. Because it worked.
Yeah, no, I consider myself a World War II fan, not a buff. I mean, most of it comes from, you know, watching Band of Brothers on repeat from like age 12 to age 27. So I'd probably say that's where my love of World War II came from. But to Noel's point, I mean, it is just such a, I don't know, just massive part of history. Especially like the culmination of things beforehand and to what we are still going through nowadays. So I like looking at it in that way.
Totally.
Agreed. And we hope that you enjoyed this exploration as well. Fellow Ridiculous Historians, let us know what some of your favorite strange stories from times of war are. We can't wait to hear from you. In the meantime, thanks so much to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks as well to Alex Williams, who composed this slap and bop.
Christopher Asiotis, who actually is the one that brought us this idea in the first place and hipped us to this movie, here in spirit, soon to be here in the digital flesh. That sounds weird. That sounds like some kinky Stephen King.
It's like a 90s sci-fi film.
Digital flesh. Exactly. Digital flesh. Long live the digital flesh. Who else? Eve Jeffcoats, also here in spirit. Miss Eve, she's the best. And thanks to you, Ben. This one could have been a real downer, but I think we navigated these choppy international waters with grace and humor and terrible British accents.
Yeah, man, agreed. Back at you. And what would this show be without terrible accents? It certainly wouldn't be Ridiculous, which is the whole reason we started this crazy thing in the first place.
That's true. And we'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.